Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Mahatma Gandhi said, "Those who believe religion and politics aren't connected don't understand either." Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Renee Garfinkel, your host on the New Books Network with the Van Leer Jerusalem series on ideas. I'm pleased to welcome Daniel Statman to the show today to talk about his important and timely book, State and Religion in Israel, A Philosophical Legal Inquiry. Professor Daniel Statman is chair of the philosophy department at the University of Haifa and specializes in ethics and political philosophy. Daniel Statman, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Before we talk about your book, Danny, I'd like to ask my guests to tell us something about themselves. So tell us about who or what in your life had a strong influence on your intellectual development.
Well, first, let me just clarify that the book is co-authored with my friend, Professor Gidi Sapir from the Law School of Bar-Ilan University. Now, as to your question, I think the most significant intellectual influence on me was by Yeshayahu Leibovitch. I'm going back maybe 45 years or so, maybe more. I once happened to see a poster about a forthcoming lecture by Leibovitch at Bar-Ilan. I hadn't known the name before. I was just 16 years old. And by the topic, I thought to myself, this sounds kind of an interesting talk. Maybe I should go to it. And I did. And it kind of changed my life. I mean, it was very inspiring, intellectually stimulating. And I think that's what got me into philosophy.
What was it about him that was so impactful?
He was very sharp in his arguments, really kind of provocative. While listening to him, you always need to think about, what would I say? Do I have any answer to that? Could I offer a better argument and so on? Also, he kind of he went against the mainstream then in the religious circles in which I grew up. So it was always very, very fascinating and thought-provoking.
Well, we could talk about Yeshayahu Leibovitz for a long time because he also impacted me when I was in high school. But we'll try to avoid that because the topic today is your and Gideon Sapir's book. So relationship between...
It's not called together unrelated because for years... Under the influence of Leibovitch, I was sure that a kind of an authentic, a committed liberal must support separation of state and religion, which is also kind of entailed by one's religious beliefs. If you take Leibovitch's line, and it took me years, kind of to release myself from this Leibovitch line. And to really go against his view here.
Right. He had the black and white thinking, the absolutist thinking, that I think is especially appealing to young people.
Absolutely, yeah.
So let's turn to your book. The relationship between religion and state is very complex, and viewed globally, it lies on a continuum from about 40% of the countries in the world that ban certain religions outright to those that restrict certain religious activities, to those that favor or prefer certain religions. Tell us about that continuum and where Israel fits on it.
Yeah, so the continuum, this continuum is around two axes. One concerns the question of religious freedom, freedom of religion, and the other concerns the question of support for religion versus separation. There are some countries who favor one religion and they discriminate against others in all kinds of ways, restricting the religious liberty of certain groups. There are countries that respect the religious freedom of all citizens, but think that the state shouldn't support any religious cause, especially not fund any religious cause. Israel is interesting because Israel, on the one hand, is a country where the state is deeply involved in religious issues. It funds synagogues as well as mosques and churches and so on, and religious schools and so on. But on the other hand, it also respects the religious freedom of all citizens.
So is the relationship between those two concepts an uneasy relationship? Separation of church and state and religious freedom, is there a contradictory relationship to them at times, or do they coexist easily?
So at times there might be some tension, but of course not necessarily. You need to balance them. So the challenge when you talk about support is the challenge of equality. Okay, so given that in most countries, almost all countries in the world, there's more than one religion, then once the state starts supporting one religion, usually the religion of the majority, there's the question of whether it offers similar support for the minority religions as well. So this, of course, is a great challenge in Israel too. So in Israel, when people talk about state and religion issues, they think almost exclusively about the Jewish religion. while the question is larger, of course, and it took time for the government offices and also for the courts to really understand that you can't give to Jewish religious causes without also giving to Muslim or Christian or whatever religious causes. Okay, so that's a challenge when you talk about support. But there's no, in principle, contradiction between, on the one hand, equally supporting various religious groups, and making sure that individuals belonging to any religious group would be able to practice their religious rituals with no interference or no disturbance by the state, which is the kind of the essence of religious freedom. The thing is that even states that support a separation, a full or close to full separation between state and religion, can and actually should and usually do respect the religious freedom of their citizens. In a sense, you could see the following way. So it's as if the state says to its religious citizens that qua religious, the religious institutions, the practices and so on, they can get no support from the state. However, to in a sense compensate for that, compensate for the fact that the religious interests or needs are not accommodated by the state, to compensate by that, the state grants them a special protection to their religious life. And this special protection comes in the guise of the right to religious freedom. So this right means that religion gets a special protection more than other kinds of activities or institutions. Okay, so in that case, in that sense, in religious individuals on the whole are treated fairly by the state.
Why is the issue of religion and state different in Judaism than Christianity, and therefore different for Israel than for European and other liberal democracies?
No, I'm not sure how different it is in terms of the fundamental moral political questions. So I could see a request from churches in some European country to be funded by the state. Think of a country like Greece. I think something like maybe 98% or 97%, a very high percentage of Greek belong to the Greek Orthodox Church. So it would make sense for Greece as a country to support the church. Support, I mean, not only both symbolically and also materially. It would make sense. So the questions that apply, that I mentioned earlier about the equal support of one group in comparison to other groups, and questions of religious freedom and so on, I think they would apply in Christian context as well. It is true that Judaism is such a religion that has a lot of practices. So these many practices, religious practices, would mean that there are more areas where Jews would ask for some kind of help, support, funding, and so on from the state, and B, that issues of religious freedom might come up. So I think it's more a matter of the number of such cases than the kind of in principle difference here.
You could argue that in recent years, European countries have restricted religious freedom in a way they hadn't before. Limitations on kosher and halal slaughtering, for example, and other things. Is that a change in principle, do you think, or only in practice?
That's kind of a tough question. I would say the latter, because it's not that the European Union has decided as a matter of principle that religious needs shouldn't have this kind of privileged status anymore. This status I was referring to earlier when I talked about the right to religious freedom. So it's still a special right. So having a right means that you have a kind of especially strong claim vis-a-vis your state when it comes to some religious needs that you think are not accommodated. So in that sense, it's more a matter of a change in practice and in the particular balancing. So it's kind of, we could talk about it, but I think from the point of view of those supporting the ban on kosher slaughtering and so on, so it's more becoming more aware of or changing the view regarding animal rights and so on. This has become kind of a much bigger issue than it used to be, and therefore this becomes a case where, with all respect to religion, we can't kind of compromise. We can't accommodate that religious need. So it's more about the change regarding animals than about religion.
I see. So it's the relative weight of different values.
Exactly, yeah.
Let's talk for a bit about freedom from religion. In the United States, the fastest growing religious group are those who identify themselves as nuns, no religious affiliation. In Israel, a large segment of the population is secular, although they do identify as Jews. Now, there are those who would say that freedom from religion is the flip side of freedom of religion in democracies, but you look at it differently. Tell us about your view of the individual's right to freedom from religion. And you can refer to the example you use in the book, however you want to express it.
Sure. So from a theoretical point of view, even the freedom of religion is a kind of a puzzling. Why is it exactly that religious believers are entitled to special protection for their practices when it happens to be incompatible with laws or rules which are generally applicable and which were not made up in a kind of a campaign against religion? There's nothing anti-religious in them. There's just this law that was made, and now it happens to be incompatible with some religious practice. So why exactly should we grant the religious an exemption? So that's a big question. And our answer in general is that in most cases, it has to do with respecting the believer's conscience. So the thought is that for believers, the religion is very important. It is what defines them as individuals. It's very central to their identity, and therefore, to make a believer act against his or her deepest beliefs is a kind of attack on their conscience or attack on their integrity, and that's why we grant them this special protection. Now, if that's the case, then with this in mind, we should move to freedom from religion. So let's say we make a law on the basis of religious considerations that bans the growing of pigs in Israel, or maybe the serving of pork in restaurants or something like that. Okay, so this, of course, is a significant restriction on liberty, and there are good arguments against it. But the question is whether the pork eaters have an additional claim in addition to the general liberal claim they have that their liberty to eat whatever they want is restricted. Is the fact that this prohibition based on religion, does that particular fact add to the moral problematics or severity of the prohibition? And here, we don't really see why this should be the case. So let's say that the same prohibition exactly would be imposed for non-religious reasons. Let's say for some theory about animal rights we just mentioned earlier. And actually there are these prohibitions on eating certain animals. I think in Israel it's illegal to eat dogs, to kill dogs and eat them. I think it's illegal, I'm not entirely sure. But definitely in other countries, there are certain types of animals that the law forbids eating, killing in order to eat, or serving in restaurants or stuff like that. So let's assume that it's the same prohibition exactly on the same kind of food, just this time on non-religious grounds. It seems to me that the fact that the basis of the prohibition is in one case religion and in another case it's, let's say, some philosophical view about animal rights shouldn't make a difference in terms of the protection granted to the individual. So in that sense, I don't think people have a right to freedom from religion. The very fact that some law originated from religion, which means that it was based on religious considerations, this very fact isn't enough to grant some citizens a special right against it. So that doesn't mean we completely reject this notion. I think this notion would apply in cases where there's something analogous to cases where the believer is forced to act against his or her conscience. So we need to find cases where some law seeks to force the secular to act against their conscience. So an example might be something like the law that still exists in Israel, unfortunately, that forces all Jewish citizens to get married through the rabbinate. Arguably, a young couple who, let's say, are completely secular and feel very much alienated from Jewish law and from the rabbis and so on, so to force them to participate in this religious ritual, maybe even to force them, you know, the groom to wear a yarmulke on his head and maybe say some kind of religious blessing and maybe force the bride to go to the mikveh to purify herself and so on. All this, I think, could be seen as analogous to cases of forcing the religious to act against their conscience. So I would think that in these cases where the secular are forced by law to participate in an active way in a religious ceremony, a religious ritual, those would be the cases where this idea of freedom from religion would apply.
And I just want to add that it's not just the Jews in Israel who can only marry through their religious community. The other religions, Muslims, Christians, and minority religions, also there is no civil marriage. You can only marry through your religious community.
Yeah, this is absolutely true. Yeah, the interesting thing is that Muslims, Christians, and so on in Israel are by and large not bothered by that. It's interesting. Most of them, I mean, the overwhelming majority of them, are, if not happy, you can't hear any real opposition. They seem to be quite happy. Let's say the Arab Christians in Israel, they get married in a church. They see it just as a matter of culture. They don't see it as anything deeply religious. And the same with Muslims, which has to do with the fact that most Israeli Muslims would define themselves either as religious or at least as what they call traditional. You won't find many Israeli Muslims who would define themselves as secular. But even if you would, I think most of them would get married, if they get married, in a kind of a religious ceremony, and wouldn't opt for the option that many young Israeli Jews opt for, which is, you know, to take a weekend in Cyprus and get a civil marriage from there.
You note in the book very reasonably that the state promotes and supports its notion of the good in many ways, from health and safety to culture. So why not religion? And you respond in the discussion of it, that health and safety are rational. But of course, as we see today with vaccine skepticism, that may be rational, but they're not universally accepted. And of course, cultural values are even more debatable. Gender equality, for example, or issues in education, which are extremely complex. So is religious coercion, I put that in air quotes, different from other governmental coercion?
Yeah, so I think philosophically, this is the most kind of interesting issue in this area. And there's a lot of writing there. So there's a very common thought among liberals that it is different, that religious coercion is particularly problematic, and that no decent liberal can support that, regardless of the kind of coercion. Even if the coercion is relatively light, the very fact that it's religion coercion is problematic. We take a different line in the book. So I think, but first of all, I think we should be clear about what we mean by religious coercion, because the very fact that some law fits religion doesn't mean that it was motivated by religion motivation, which is the main issue on the table, whether the religious motivation is problematic. In Israel, which is often referred to as a state where there's a lot of religious coercion, so I think when you look at the actual laws referred to, many of those who support these laws, especially the secular who support those laws, supported in the fact in the past when they were actually made these laws, sincerely believe that these laws were justified on kind of a national grounds. Okay, so even in the years before the state was established, many people, many Jews thought that the Sabbath, the Shabbat in Israel, as a Jewish state, should have a special atmosphere, which isn't necessarily exactly what the halakha, Jewish law, requires, but still should be different than a regular day. So the secular politicians or thinkers who supported all kinds of restrictions on working on Shabbat and so on, sincerely did so for what they saw as kind of cultural, national reasons. And this also has to do with the idea of Israel as a Jewish state. So as a Jewish state, it should have some kind of a kind of public character, which would express its Jewishness, not because this is something that God commanded, or that the rabbi said. It's just because we're Jews, and this is how Jews live. And actually, even from the religious point of view, when you look at the actual laws, many of them don't really make sense if you judge them from a religious point of view. So think of let's say public transportation on the Sabbath. It's something we talk about in the book. So from a strictly halachic Jewish law point of view, it doesn't really make sense to outlaw public transportation while allowing private transportation. If anything, then from the point of view of halakha, it's better to have people taking a bus, and let's say 50 people riding on a bus instead of 50 cars. I think very clearly in this example, the Orthodox who support this prohibition on public transportation, what's really what really motivates them is not a coercion in the sense of making other Jews' behavior compatible with what God wants them to do, but rather an attempt to shape the public sphere in ways that be compatible with the kind of the atmosphere of the Sabbath. So even if one accepted that religious coercion in the strict sense of the word is problematic, which we deny, I think when you look at the actual cases, most of them are different. So nobody would deny that it's okay for countries in general, for Israel in particular, to impose all kinds of restrictions in the public sphere, because the state has its own character. So, for instance, you have some holidays, so you don't allow traffic in some streets for that holiday, not for the Sabbath, on the Sunday or whatever. Or you have some parade, or you close some road and have a promenade there. Just for the sake of the holiday or whatever. Now, it's true that from our point of view, even if some law is 100% based on religious considerations, something like, okay, we want this law passed because we believe that this is what God wants or something like that, I don't think it can be ruled out a priori. I don't think that the very fact that the law is based on religious considerations makes it in some way illegitimate or indecent or unfair or anything of that kind. And this has to do with the point that I don't think there's any reason for us to accept in this discussion a priori that religious considerations in comparison to non-religious ones are in some sense irrational or non-rational, while all other bases for laws are rational. And even if people don't agree with them, if only they thought hard about it, they would agree. I just don't think this is the case. There are many laws that many citizens don't agree with, deeply don't agree with, and still nobody thinks that the fact they don't agree with makes these laws unfair or illegitimate or anything of that kind.
And there's also the argument or the pressure from the values, liberal values, of being a good neighbor, that is, not disturbing someone else's religious practice. So there is that argument that if opening your store or driving a bus down a particular street will be disturbing to the culture, religious or other, of the people in that neighborhood that day, one ought to restrict oneself in accommodation to that. That seldom gets into the argument, but I think in real life it operates that way.
Yeah, I think it does get into the argument quite often, especially when we think about religious areas, neighborhoods, or settlements, and so on. I live in a kind of a relatively small place in the Galilee, which is defined as religious. So there are no cars here that can drive in or through the place on Shabbat. What justifies that? So I think it's a matter of respecting the right of a community to shape its public sphere to an extent. Now, this depends on all kinds of conditions. For instance, the extent of restrictions that imposes on others, how much this is important for the community, and so on and so forth. So I think you're absolutely right that when you think of neighborhoods or areas which are, let's say, almost 100% religious, then they have a stronger claim for consideration. So it has to do with the transportation or traffic on Shabbat and so on. On the other hand, if it's a main road running through the neighborhood, and the meaning of closing this road would be a very heavy burden on the other citizens, then maybe we wouldn't be able to give them this accommodation.
If liberal, democratic, and secular ideals were a product of a particular time, the Enlightenment, what are the implications of this time, the postmodern, and one might say the post-secular era, on the relationship between religion and state?
I'm not sure I entirely understand what you mean by this.
Well, there was a breakthrough philosophical outlook in the Enlightenment period, from which liberal democracies and secular thinking grew. Individual freedom, notions of the polis that didn't come down from God or the king. But now we live in a postmodern time where the idea of what is correct isn't necessarily based on evidence or on reason. So I'm just asking you to reflect, if you would, on what the implications of postmodernism are for the relationship between religion and state.
Well, I guess I don't completely buy that we live in a postmodern world.
Say some more about that.
Yeah, sure. So what exactly postmodern is a question. You know, it refers to many views. I think what they share is a kind of skepticism about the truth or something like that. And I just think that most people don't really believe that skepticism. Okay, when they're on guard in some philosophical discussion, they might throw these ideas in the air, but when they're off guard and you talk to them about fairness of political arrangements, about what should be done, what shouldn't be done, and so on, they have very, very clear ideas. And they present arguments, they try to bring evidence, empirical evidence, philosophical evidence. So this kind of skepticism is reserved to the kind of philosophical seminar, but people don't really buy into it.
That's a relief.
It is. I completely agree. And my view on this is very much influenced by the late philosopher and lawyer Ronald Dworkin, who fought against this skepticism all his life, but also thought that people weren't really serious about it, in a sense. So it's really very interesting to see this difference, that when you ask people about, you know, truth or, you know, these abstract terms, they come up with all these half arguments that, no, it's all relative and subjective and so on.
Right.
And then a day later, when they're off guard and you talk to them about, you know, you say to them, did you hear about this new law that the ultra-Orthodox, the Haredim have passed? Isn't that outrageous? So they don't say to you, well, who knows what's outrageous? It's all subjective. No, that's not their reaction. They have a very strong view. So I'm not very impressed by the impression often conveyed that people in the way people think about political issues, they don't really believe in truth or something like that.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that. What about context, specifically geography? Does or should that make a difference to the meaning of the relationship between religion and state? What I mean is, Israel is in the Middle East, where all countries are religious, Islamic, and none are democratic. Should the weight and balance of your arguments be different for countries in, for example, North America compared to the Middle East?
That's a nice question. I never thought of that. Interesting.
Succeeded. Good. I'm glad.
Yeah. My gut reaction is that it shouldn't make a difference. So this has to do with the fact that modern states are, to a large extent, kind of self-contained entities that can and usually run their own affairs, including the way they regulate issues of state and religion, regardless of what other countries do around them. Think of other rights or issues. So, issue concerning gender and gender equality. So, probably in all the countries around us, there's much less gender equality than in Israel. That shouldn't provide us with any reason to kind of try to be kind of more similar to our neighbors. We might try to influence them, but this is not something we would like to imitate. So, see, I think the same here. We need to think about the right reasons and the way to behave and to regulate the issues of state and religion in accordance to our better understanding within Israel. And I think we can completely ignore the way Egypt or Sudan or Iraq or wherever, the kind of arrangements that exist over there. But I think I would take your question to the domestic context, and with a little twist, and I would reformulate it as the question of the relation between the local and the national. The question is whether and to what extent issues of state and religion should be decided upon on a national level or on the local level. And that's, I think, an issue we didn't take up in the book enough, and it's really interesting. On the one hand, you would think that these are kind of in principle questions, so it should come from the Knesset, the national level. On the other hand, it would make a lot of sense to say that the local government should, local authority, they should decide. They know their exactly the kind of communities they have in their own city or region, and they can make their own accommodations and compromises and so on, and therefore maybe we should leave some of the decisions to the local local bodies.
Does the size of the religious minority who is receiving special accommodation, should that make a difference? For example, the Amish in America have some very special accommodations that nobody else has. They don't have to participate in Social Security, the national insurance, for example. But they are a tiny minority in a big country. So talk about the special arrangements made for the ultra-Orthodox at the time of Israel's founding, and the challenge today when they're now about 12% of the country's population.
Yeah, so I think this is precisely right. The smaller the community, usually the easier it is to accommodate the requests. Think about pacifists. So when you have a very small group of pacifists, it's very easy to grant them all an exemption and be very, very generous with them. However, if you have a very big group of a large group of citizens who are pacifists, then it granting all of them an exemption would make it very hard for the country to run its army and to accommodate all its security needs, and therefore it would be much harder to grant them all exemption. So the same would apply to these religious issues as well. And I think you're absolutely right with the ultra-Orthodox. So the bigger this community becomes, and the stronger they get politically, the weaker their claim for special protection.
And what kind of accommodations or support do the religious minorities in Israel receive? About 18 or 20% of the country are Muslims, Christians, and Druze.
Yeah, right. So in terms of religious freedom, they enjoy the same kind of protection as granted to Jews, because this is a right granted to individuals respecting their conscience. So in that sense, there's no difference. There's no significant difference. In terms of state support, as we talked earlier, I think in the last, let's say, two decades, there's growing understanding that they should be receiving an equal share, I mean, in accordance to their size, in the budget allocated for religious causes. So, for instance, there was a very famous petition to the Supreme Court regarding the funding of Muslim cemeteries, the claim being that they were funded less than Jewish ones, and the Supreme Court completely accepted it and said that they should be funded just as Jews in accordance to their relative size. So I think that's where we're going to. But nonetheless, I should say that in this issue of funding religion and caring about religious freedom, as in other fields, it's still, I think, by and large true that Israel still doesn't completely see the non-Jewish citizens as completely equal. So when they think of religion, they think mainly about Jews. So you need to kind of make a special effort to make it clear to the decision makers or to the courts that we have a problem here. And when the decision makers or the courts realize that there is a problem, they, as I said, they rule that there should be equality. But I think that there's more kind of education to kind of educational efforts to be made among Israeli Jews to realize that, hey, this is a Jewish state, but there are, you know, many Muslims here and Christians and Jews, and they need to be accommodated as well.
Finally, Danny, you make a number of recommendations for policy changes at the end of your book, some of them quite wide-ranging, from marriage and divorce to the requirement of teaching basic skills, the core curriculum in religious schools. Which of your recommendations do you think have the best chance of being accepted in the near future?
Well, maybe public transportations on the Sabbath is now actually happening. There was something in today's newspaper about it. So we're not entirely there, but I think that's where we're going. It's going to happen. Maybe not completely, maybe not the regular lines, but it's going to happen. If you ask me what for me would be the most important thing right now, I would think that a reform in the laws of marriage and divorce. But unfortunately, I don't see that forthcoming. I don't see that forthcoming. And this has to do with a kind of a curious fact that it just for those who should care about it are young secular couples who don't want a religious marriage. But the thing is that they discover that they can live together and start families and have kids without being married under the legal arrangement of what we call cohabitation, or in Hebrew, yiduim betzibur. So an increasing number, common law. Yeah, exactly. So an increasing number of young secular couples don't even trouble themselves to go to Cyprus and get a civil marriage from there. They just give up on the official definition of marriage, and the sky hasn't fallen, everything is fine. So there's no kind of push, there's no pressure from those couples on their politicians to make this a condition for joining the coalition or anything of that kind. So that's why I don't think any change here is forthcoming. Regarding the teaching of core curriculum in the ultra-Orthodox schools, there we might see some change, but this would be contingent on the continuation of the present coalition, and who knows what happens there. If this coalition manages to complete its term, its whole 4 years, then maybe we'll start to see a beginning of a change in this field.
Well, you've really helped clarify the sometimes controversial relationship between religion and state for us. Before I let you go today, can you tell us what you're working on now and what's next for you?
Well, there's several things on my table right now. One of them is a project on the notion of objectification. This has nothing special to do with state and religion. I try to see whether this notion of objectification, which is so central in feminist philosophy, whether it makes sense, and especially whether it manages to explain the aggression, hostility of men against women in under certain conditions. I analyze a list of empirical studies that have pointed to some causal connection between what the researchers call sexual objectification and the various forms of hostility and aggression against women. And I criticize these studies and try to offer my own account.
Well, that's a very important topic and much needed. I'll keep my eye out to look for your publications in that arena. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today on the podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
And thanks to our researcher, Bela Pasikoff. If you've enjoyed this conversation, please subscribe to the Van Leer Series on Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast platform.